So I foresee a future in which we have a new class of genetic haves and have-nots. This is a national security threat. Here's why. Other countries don't interpret life the same way that we do in the U.S. It begs the question, what's a future war crime? Can you psychologically torture a thinking, sentient thing that maybe just doesn't have a body?
Welcome to The Convergence, the Army's Mad Scientist podcast. I'm Matt Sanisbert of the Mad Scientist team, and I'll be joined in just a moment by Luke Shabro, Deputy Director of Mad Scientist. Mad Scientist is a U.S. Army initiative that continually explores the future of warfare, challenges assumptions, and collaborates with academia, industry, and government. You can connect with us through Twitter, at @ArmyMadSci, or subscribe to the blog, The Mad Scientist Laboratory, at madsciblog.tradoc.army.mil. On today's episode, we'll be talking with Amy Webb, quantitative futurist and CEO of the Future Today Institute. She'll be talking to us today about her approach to foresight, the challenges and opportunities of synthetic biology, and what it all means for the future of the U.S. Army. As always, the views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Army Futures Command, or Training and Doctrine Command. Let's get started. Amy, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, Amy, to start off, can you tell our audience a little bit about your background and how you came to be one of the country's leading futurists?
I mean, I think the short answer is that I kept my head down and I outworked my competition. Just brute force. But foresight itself, there are different backgrounds and people with different disciplines. There's foresight related to risk. There's strategic foresight in the military, design and design thinking. My background is game theory and economics. So my approach to foresight is kind of using what I know about models combined with orthogonal thinking to develop plausible futures. So if I were to trace my lineage back, for those of you who know anything at all about this stuff, I would say that for me, Herman Kahn was pretty influential. He was at RAND in the 50s and 60s and was tasked with, I think for the Air Force, trying to imagine the aftermath of nuclear war, and wrote incredibly effective scenarios really for the first time. It was the first divergence away from charts and graphs that showed numbers but didn't convey any real narrative. He did something smart, which was just in a very sort of methodical way explain what that aftermath might look like, just very bare bones. And it was so shocking to the people who read it in the military, and then the versions of it that became public, that he was labeled a monster for having such a almost lackadaisical sort of calm outlook on what the horrific aftermath might look like. But that's why they were so effective. So I'd say Herman Kahn, and then Pierre Vac in the 70s, he built on Kahn's scenario planning. And Herman Kahn's background was also game theory for use in the private sector while Vac was at the Royal Dutch Shell Company, and that's what resulted in the company being prepared for oil shocks. So this is kind of my kind of roundabout way saying, this is a discipline that anybody can get into. Anybody can study foresight, and you can come at it from different disciplines, and you can practice it in different ways. Design and thinking about the future of design and art and creativity is one application of it. I'm pretty much focused just on strategy.
No, I think that's an amazing approach, and I really like you bringing in Herman Kahn. You had mentioned in your books previously about him. Can you explain to our audience how you approach foresight? I know you said you focus on the strategy aspects. Does that approach change when you're working with a government agency as opposed to a private company?
Yeah, so it does. There are parts that remain constant regardless of the work that I'm doing. There are always three stages of work. There are inputs, so that's forces, signals, trends, that represents change. There are outcomes, so those are scenarios describing plausible futures. And then usually there's some form of action. So that is also what's known as backcasting. But basically, it's like reverse engineering, a preferred future or trying to avoid risk or something like that back to the present. Regardless of who we're doing the work for, it's always data-driven, and I'm always using quant models whenever possible, which is not always the case. But the biggest difference between government and business scenarios and foresight is that, and this is just my observation, government doesn't necessarily want answers. So a lot of times it's more like just what are some windows into possible futures, possible worlds. And that sometimes leads to decisions. Oftentimes it doesn't. That is 100% not the case in the world of business, right? So in the business arena, this work has to lead to some type of tangible action. So business wants answers. The biggest criticism of foresight, I think, that I've seen is that it's interesting work, but not necessarily seen as urgent. And there have been two schools of thought on strategic foresight. The one is, you know, we're not here to make recommendations or make decisions for you. We're just here to tell you what we see, right? And the other school of thought is, well, we gotta not, you know, tell you what we see, but also make recommendations. That's kind of why we're here. And these two camps really are at loggerheads. They really disagree. I would say that I'm in that latter camp. Because if the scenario, if the work doesn't lead to action, then it's a really great novel, right? But that's typically not what I'm being asked to do. Now, military scenarios, because some of this work is done in the military, does typically lead to some type of action or some type of answer, but in a more narrow way. So it tends to be more like a traditional regression. You know, we're looking for choice A or choice B. We're looking to adjust a handful of variables and see what the potential outcomes might be, which makes sense because a lot of that scenario planning oftentimes is wargaming, and you're just trying to figure out plausible outcomes within a narrow set of variables. I bet you a whole bunch of people, though, would absolutely disagree with everything I just said, which is fine. That's one of the cool things about foresight. You know, like we debate and discuss.
Exactly. You know, we like to have the divergent thought on here as well as the convergent thought. You know, we like to see what other people aren't saying or what other people disagree with. So let's talk a little bit about synthetic biology then. You've written and talked significantly about SynBio recently. Why do you believe this area will be meaningful in the near future?
Yeah, so synthetic biology is probably a new term to most people. Another way to think about it is engineered biology. So basically engineering biological code to give it new and enhanced purposes, or even creating something new. So another way to think about this is read versus edit versus write permissions, like in a shared Microsoft Word document or Google document. If you have, so like if you think about a document, if you have read-only access, you can observe what's there and you can watch other people in there editing or writing, but observation is all you got. So when Watson and Crick, who were first in the process of discovering the shape of DNA and building that model, using somebody else's research, by the way, they were borrowing heavily from Rosalind Franklin and never giving her any credit for this. But that first model was like, you know, read-only access to life. Let's say that you had edit permissions for that Word doc or your Google doc. That gives you the ability to change words and to move text around. You're still kind of limited though, right? You're limited to just working within a narrow set of parameters. In biology, that's CRISPR. So you've probably heard of CRISPR-Cas9 or CRISPR in general. That's the edit function. So that's the ability to sort of splice and move around biological letters, ACTG. It's powerful, but not super duper precise. Engineered biology, synthetic biology, this is write level permission. So again, in our document example, if you have write level permissions, you can basically do anything you want with that document. You can make something totally new. You can delete all of the text. You can go back a couple of revisions. You can make ridiculous font choices. You know, you're still using an alphabet and creating words, but those could be anything. And something that might have started out as a, you know, high school 5-paragraph essay could wind up becoming a haiku at the end. So that's kind of what we're talking about. And the reason that this is so important is because it gives us more control over how life evolves. And I'm talking about all life, right? So not just humans, but also like, you know, plants and viruses and just about anything that you can imagine. And the reason that we're kind of entering into this new era is because we finally have the compute, there's finally enough resources. It's a relatively new field, but it's one that I think is analogous to AI, in that I think 10 years from now, we'll all be talking about synthetic biology the way that everybody talks about AI today, which is to say, enormous driver of business, enormous concern of governments around the world, military applications, and everybody's going to have an opinion on it, even though many people will not be informed very well in making that opinion.
When you and your co-author Andrew Hessel wrote in The Genesis Machine about synthetic bio, really creating kind of a new class disparity of new have and have nots, not just in a wealth disparity. Can you kind of expand on that?
Right. So one of the things that we're already starting to see in this country, in the US, who can access fertility care? So if you are somebody who has tried to have a family, and in fact, this is what the book opens with, we were pretty raw and vulnerable and just told our own stories. And that includes me. So I had significant problems trying to get and stay pregnant. And, you know, the answer was always, you seem really healthy. We can't figure out what's wrong. And it was like, well, clearly there's something wrong here because we've been at it for a long time. And, you know, we don't have a kid. I'm in a situation where we could afford to go to fertility specialists. You know, we could afford to do everything in our power to start the family that we wanted. Which means that my DNA, and we did eventually have a daughter who's awesome, but my DNA is a more, from a financial, I guess, point of view, is coming from a more financially privileged place than somebody else's. So my this is my way of saying, sometimes we talk about editing biology or intentionally designing biology, we immediately jump to blonde hair, blue-eyed super babies. And I guess the point that I'm trying to make is, yeah, I think the future is going to look different than that. And there will be cases where I don't think some of the solutions presented by this technology, meaning longer lifespans, being able to perform genetic surgery on embryos, for example, before they're implanted to change errant genetic code or potentially to enhance someday. I'm curious to know whether that's going to become affordable and available to everybody. And I think given what we've seen in the past, the answer to that is no. So I foresee a future in which we have a new class of genetic haves and have-nots. And the way that those camps get separated has to do with wealth, but also probably religious beliefs. My assumption is that more religious families will be less tolerant of any type of genetic changes or enhancement. You know, and so the social values that are present now, or at the time that this really starts moving towards the mainstream, social values that are present at that point will wind up literally embedded in the DNA of the future. And that's going to be challenging for every society to manage, including our own, because this is not just restricted to the US.
Yeah, I think you bring up some really interesting points because, you know, there is feelings out there about gene editing and the technologies you discuss that does it change you as a person? So obviously there's physiological changes, but if you take someone who has ADHD and you find people who are neurodivergent who feel like in a way it can be a superpower for them as well, and in a way somewhat defines their personality in some ways, do you change that person? So what kind of moral and ethical beyond the changes themselves about personhood and personality, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of these really challenging questions. And unfortunately, we're living through a time when I think having a rational public discussion is just not feasible. Interestingly enough, the earliest futurists, including people like H.G. Wells, the famed science fiction writer, he was actually trying to establish an academic discipline of foresight. Later on in his life, he became a pretty ardent eugenicist. We kind of see that happening a lot. I think in many cases, it doesn't start from we need to eliminate the bad. I think it's more like how do we optimize the good and like make that, you know, succeed over time. The problem is we don't have any singular cohesive viewpoint on what is the good, right? So as of right now, and by the way, regulations are all over the place. So in some countries, you know, you can do genetic screening to look for certain types of diseases that are negative. But it's generally frowned upon to do genetic screening to look for signs that correlate with higher intelligence, such as we can even like know what that is. But it's not, to my knowledge, it's not totally illegal. And there are commercial entities now offering to screen for things like cognitive ability, things like that. So again, I think that's something we just need to have a conversation about it. Now, if you were to ask me if there was a way to eliminate certain parts of the genome that make us vulnerable to disease or to like eliminate certain types of disease, given what we just saw with vaccine hesitancy, it would be pretty great to make humans more resilient so that we were less dependent on vaccines. So we didn't have to go through this again the next time there was a pathogen, right? But that means that people are going to have to be okay with something intentionally changing their genetic makeup. And so few people really even understand how biology works. Like, I feel like that's going to be a rough one to have a conversation about, let alone have happen. Now, in the same breath, I will say, we are definitely seeing some movement in this in other countries. So China has a very different approach, I think, as everybody knows or assumes at this point, to genetic privacy and to editing and to nationwide DNA storage and collection and things like that.
It's a really complex topic. And as you and Luke both pointed out, we tend to think about these things first and foremost from a cosmetic point of view, but it's really the deeper implications that you guys both brought up that are probably going to be most important. So along those lines, what implications do you see with SynBio for the Army that we should be looking at?
So many implications. So let me start with the one that I think will get everybody very excited. So there's some research being done right now on like a device that's about the size of your mobile phone that in a battlefield environment would be able to screen and sequence in the field a novel pathogen. So let's say you're on a battlefield, there's some new something that somebody encounters. There's a reaction that, again, is new and novel. Being able to sequence immediately to figure out what it is, right? What that pathogen or potential, you know, chemical or whatever it is. And then being able to potentially using that same device and the cloud, know which, let's say, you know, which genetic material and reagents that you would have kind of like in a tiny little supply kit, which ones to use as an antidote or even to mix a sort of vaccine in the field as a preventative measure. So I know that that research has been underway already. I think that's a DARPA project. And I think battlefield readiness is a huge piece of this. There's also really interesting things around synthetic materials. So we think of synthetic biology as being like editing humans. You can edit many other things, like fibers. So imagine a warfighting suit where the entire suit itself is like a data collecting and data generating device for the purpose of understanding conditions, maybe changing in real time to make it more or less flexible or more or less heat resistant, you know, things like that. So I think that there are a ton of super interesting applications for the purpose of making forces more resilient and better protected in battlefield environments. Now, I also think this represents a massively new expanded threat environment, right? So the obvious, you know, thing to think about are novel pathogens, viruses. You know, again, viruses, it's just code, right? It's just code. It's like biological malware. So creating novel pathogens that don't necessarily have to kill troops, but could just immobilize them. So imagine releasing a pathogen that just causes like super bad lower GI issues and, you know, diarrhea. It doesn't have to kill these people to make it so uncomfortable that they just can't effectively do their jobs, right, out in the field. Pathogens for just one person. So let's say you've got a high profile person stage in a, you know, whatever. Again, you could create a designer pathogen or virus just for them. And you could do that at scale. So if you have lots of individual novel viruses, suddenly that threat environment becomes really, really complicated because now you're trying to figure out who's doing what. I would also say there are things like new types of machines and new types of computers. So AI and SynBio kind of go hand in hand. And there's this project called DishBrain, which is crazy interesting. If any of you, like me, spend your weekend nights reading academic papers, this is when to get your hands on. But this is a Petri dish that was full. It was like they put like a million brain cells and connected it with, you know, a sensor-based system. Anyhow, this is a literal brain machine computer. Unlike any that have existed before, and they usually in like AI, the way a lot of systems are trained historically is through games. So they started with Pong, DishBrain on Pong, and like DishBrain was able to learn without a human in the loop, learn and beat Pong orders of magnitude faster than any AI that's ever existed, and they think it's because it was. It had human cells in it. So this thing was, to the extent that a computer believes, it like believed that it was the paddles, that it was inside of this thing playing. Now, I think we're a universe away from creating truly synthetic brains, right? Or truly hybrid brain machine computers. But this is the kind of thing that if I was the Army, I would start thinking about now because it potentially represents a new type of weapon. It potentially, you know, represents a new way to do like hyper real time, like high frequency strategy, right? Things like that. Anyways, and then there's all kinds of other things to be thinking about, like enhanced soldiers and the like. But yeah, for me, this should be something that the Army is very focused on.
I think you're spot on, and there's so many technologies with this myriad of possibilities and opportunities, but also challenges and really, really a lot of ethical, moral implications and potentially conundrums.
Right. It begs the question, you know, what's a future war crime? Can you psychologically torture a thinking, sentient thing that maybe just doesn't have a body?
Yeah, is biology, is the organic origin of something the only thing that differentiates personhood from non-personhood, despite being sentient?
Right. This is a national security threat. Here's why. Because other countries don't interpret life the same way that we do in the U.S. So the challenges that we have as a society deciding what is life and when is life, and who should have the ability to choose what to do with life. And here I'm talking about the recent abortion debate. That is, to me, an easy conversation compared to what we're about to face when it comes to these organs on a chip, this biological system on a chip. Is this thing human? We have a somewhat sentient pile of brain cells in a dish. Like, is that life? And I just think we are not prepared. And the fact that we will wind up arguing about that while China pushes ahead and does its own thing is a security issue for the United States.
Amy, you've kind of talked about all these emerging technologies. You wrote previously in The Signals Are Talking and as well with the Big Nine about what do these trends mean and what is disruptive, vice what is kind of just evolutionary in a way. And I think one of the interesting things you've discussed before is the idea of what is trendy, so flying cars, versus what are real trends. And so with that, though, you know, and I think maybe we've led you to this answer already, but what do you see as really the next great societal disruptor?
Right. I mean, in the immediate term, it has to do with generative AI. So these are especially the new open source tools that are just scraping data publicly available that can generate things, whether that is content or decisions for investors. You know, that does concern me. And I think that's going to disrupt a lot of things because it starts to amplify things like misinformation. It gives superpowers to those who know how to harness and use these tools. It has implications for how people express themselves and see themselves. And I also think that for a foreign actor, if they're trying to sow distrust, these are wonderful tools for people like that to use. So that's in the air term. Again, I think this engineer biology stuff, which I know sounds like Star Trek. Oh, and you know what? We're talking on Star Trek Day. So there you go. I know that feels pretty far off, but it's not. It's here. And the reason that I think that I think that there are enormous benefits, but I think the potential disruptive factor here has to do with people reconciling what they want for their future and what they believe to be true today. And the role that biology plays. I also don't want to weed out the exuberance of investors who are throwing money at this right now, the way that they were once throwing money at AI. And when all of the huge promises being made failed to materialize in the 80s, we went through what was known as the AI winter. Funding dried up, projects dried up. You know, we don't want that to happen with SynBio. Our government is woefully underinvested in this space, as it was in AI. Again, that is not true of some of our foreign adversaries. So I think this is a place that we want to give some more attention to.
I think those are extremely interesting points because we find ourselves at these inflection points where you really have to look at there's government, military, societal, ethical, moral, religious, crazy amount of implications. And as you said, there's that tension, though, with the investment into that. And different nation states and even corporations are going to have different thresholds for what they consider appropriate or allowable in these circumstances. And so I think there's a lot to be said for that. And, you know, I think there was coming out of, so to speak, that AI winter, you had really a time period where people were starting to talk about AI and ML more again, starting on the fringes and starting to get into mainstream. But it took several years, even within the government and DOD, to become something that got talked about as the hot topic issue. And I think SynBio falls into that category where we could see not something as often broached right now, but in a year to 3 years, we could really be talking about it every day the way AI is.
I totally agree. And if I may, forgive me for saying this, you know, the U.S. military showed up so late to the AI party. You know, I know that things are moving in a different direction now, but it is really astonishing how long it took for our military and all of the associated parties to recognize that the future of wars in many ways are going to be fought in code, not hand-to-hand combat. And that has, you know, huge implications. And I'm worried that we are going to show up late to the SynBio party too. And I think that is a dangerous, vulnerable position that puts us in.
Absolutely. I think, you know, some of that struggle was being such a big paradigm shift from your identity as a military that we fight with people and we fight on the ground and in the air and in the sea, but we fight with these weapons and it's the people who are doing the fighting, and digital or virtual cyber warfare. All these areas can be kind of ethereal to people who are used to throwing lead downrange.
I totally agree, but I think that the other piece of this has to do with updating priors, like updating business models, because this was also partially a business issue. Like, what does procurement look like for AI? You know what I mean? Like, there's just, we have to be willing to be more nimble. It doesn't mean throwing out established practices, but it does mean thinking about transformation in a very different way. And if we don't do that, you know, the U.S. was very late to recognizing China as a diplomatic, militaristic, and economic pacing threat. We got to get up to speed on this stuff. And we have to be more nimble and more agile.
Amy, this has been amazing, and we could honestly talk to you for hours and hours about all this. But we're going to transition to our rapid fire questions. These are questions we like to ask all our guests to get to know them a little bit better. So first question, what technology or trend keeps you up at night?
Open source image generators. So think DALL-E, but the open source kind, not good.
Yeah, scary stuff, and saw some recent reporting on that as well. What's something about you most people might not know that you're willing to share on air?
As a kid, I did something called the Future Problem Solvers of America. And if you have kids, this is actually, if the program still exists, it was a really great program. I did it in middle school and was on a competitive team. And without realizing what I was doing, it was learning how to write scenarios. And it was like a super great program. So
that's really amazing and indicative of your future career.
Yeah, it was fun.
And then our last question, which is often called the hardest of these, what is your favorite movie?
Oh, that's easy. Dr. Strangelove.
Yes, there we go.
Dr. Strangelove, followed by, and this is a close second, The Big Lebowski.
Those are two fantastic choices. Mad Cy was already a big fan of you, but you grow in our esteem with those choices as well. Amy, it's been really honestly a pleasure. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. Where can folks follow you at?
Well, I try very hard not to be tracked, but I'm on selected social media using my full name, Amy Webb, and I post stuff on LinkedIn, and I'm around.
All right. Fantastic. Well, thanks for being here, and we look forward to seeing more work from you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Amy.
Thanks for listening to The Convergence. I'd like to thank our guest, Amy Webb, for talking with us. You can connect with Mad Scientist through Twitter at @ArmyMadSci, and don't forget to subscribe to our blog, The Mad Scientist Laboratory, at madsciblog.tradoc.army.mil. Finally, if you enjoyed this podcast, please consider giving us a rating or review on Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you accessed it. This feedback helps improve future episodes of The Convergence and allows us to reach a bigger and broader audience.